Hello and welcome to The Bagel Bite. I'm Hayden Cohen, and for this bite I present an interview with the outgoing chief exec of UJIA, Michael Wieger. UJIA, or the United Jewish Israel Appeal, is a multi-million pound charity that is the educational charity for the UK Jewish community. We chat about birthright, crisis mode, Israeli projects that work with both Jews and Arabs together, how to be a great fundraiser, how to be a great chief exec, Zionism, challenges to Jewish charities, and the plethora of Jewish charities that UJIA support. As ever, if you're enjoying The Bagel, please do share it around. Sign up to the mailing list, strike up a conversation on Twitter, Facebook, with each other, or even on your smart speaker of choice. If every listener tells two of their friends, then there will be two more ever listening. And that's why I'm known for my great math skills. Anyway, your support is not only greatly appreciated, but goes a long way to ensuring the longevity of this show. Also, if you have any suggested features or have something you want to share, email oy@bagelpodcast.com. Right, pressing play now. So I'm joined by Michael Wieger, who is the chief exec of UJIA. Although, to be fair, when this goes out, you may not be at that point, but you're coming to the...
Well, that sounds terrible, but yes, you are correct. I will be ending my tenure at the end of February.
Yeah, but my way was more misleading, so it's fun.
It's true.
So maybe, and I apologise for the number of listeners that do know what UJIA does, but I do find that it's one of these organisations that the majority of the community in the UK has heard of, but they might not necessarily know what it does. So how about we start with that?
Sure. So UJIA is Britain's largest Israel charity, and Israel is the glue that binds us together, and we engage with Israel in two different but overlapping ways. Firstly, we support a wide range of educational and employment-related and community regeneration-related projects in Israel, focused mostly in the Galilee in the north. And secondly, we are responsible for engaging thousands of British Jews with Israel as a key component of their Jewish identity. And those we do both in the UK and also by sending young people to Israel on all sorts of educational programs, short-term and long-term.
So how many of... But there's this weird intersection, isn't there, in terms of UJIA and all the various youth movements who you know, they have their own ideology and mission statements and this type of thing. And then UJIA, does UJIA fit in with that, or do those organisations have to fit in with UJIA?
Well, by and large, we really welcome the fact that the youth movements represent a very wide range of religious and political views. We ourselves are a non-political charity. We don't take a position, but we support movements ranging from Habonim more to the left, to Bnei Akiva more to the sort of centre-right, secular movement, Habonim, a much more orthodox movement like Ezra. So we are not trying to make those movements like each other or to dilute their ideologies. But we welcome the fact that there is a broad tent in this community, and we want to underpin that by both financial support and a wide range of consultative services.
You might not want to answer this, but I mean, I feel like that tent's getting broader. But I know this, you know, the last summer, in summer 2018, was a bit fraught, particularly birthright. So yeah, do you maybe want to provide a little bit of context for those, just a little bit for those listeners that don't know what happened?
Sure. Well, birthright itself was not very problematic for us in the UK. It might be in the future, you know, I can't predict, but it was a very big story more in the United States. And what happened in the UK was some young people who were involved in an organization called Na'amod, which is molded on an American organization called If Not Now, came to Heathrow Airport when a group was going on birthright, and they sort of handed out some leaflets and information to people going on birthright, saying they should question what they're told on birthright, particularly with regard to Israel's treatment of Palestinians. And UJIA's view was, it's a free country, they are allowed to have their opinions, and we had no problem with it. And what happened in the United States on a couple of occasions now is people have gone on birthright and have left the bus in protest of what they were being told. As of January 1, 2019, that's not happened to a UK bus. and that situation. So that itself is not very problematic. I'm entirely comfortable with people who protest quietly and responsibly. There's no issue there.
And also, just again, but I don't like to presume anything. Birthright is a free trip for young people, and that age changes every so often.
That's correct. Yes, it does change often. Yeah. Right now in the UK, most people go on Birthright are aged between 19 and 26. There've been a couple of pilot groups of people who are a little bit older than that, but roughly most people who go aged between 19 and 26. And of course, someone's paying. It's free to the user, and the money is being paid through a combination of the generosity of the UJA's donors and the Israeli government and some large international Jewish philanthropies. It's a three-way funding relationship. But the UJA is the UK funding partner of Birthright.
I am a past participant of Birthright. I've done that myself. And it's interesting, actually, because when I went on Birthright, I thought it was handled pretty carefully in terms of showing both sides of that debate. And, you know, yeah, it's just that might be my perception, right? So I might come from a very different background and experience than other people that went on it. But I thought it was handled quite delicately.
So I think most tour guides do handle it pretty well. And I've observed, and I've actually run Birthright programs from Israel in a previous life. And I've been observing Birthright really since it first began. And in my experience, the vast majority of Birthright tour guides understand their educational role very well and are really careful to present a multiplicity of views to young people. However, this is a project that comes from Israel. It has an Israeli perspective. It's not trying to be anything else.
Why is that an issue? It's something that I find fascinating, right? So as somebody who is Jewish, is it not natural that your bias is going to be towards other people of that same community, and you just acknowledge that bias?
Well, you and I might agree on that, Hayden, but I think there are significant numbers of young Jews who have a more universalist worldview, and whilst they're interested in exploring their Jewish background, they also want to understand much more about Palestinian narratives. From Birthright's perspective, it's not the easiest issue in the world to resolve. Right now, I know that Birthright is giving a lot of serious thought to how to engage on this issue. They understand, they've heard the message coming particularly from North America, but also from us in the UK and from elsewhere in the world, that we want to be sure that Birthright is doing a really good job at letting young people know that there are multiple views in Israel and not all of them come from an Israeli Jewish Zionist perspective. And it's something which we are in constant discussions about. The leadership of Birthright is aware of this issue, but what it doesn't want is to allow its programs to be hijacked by people doing provocative acts, which are there simply to go online virally and aren't really interested in engaging at the time with what's going on. And that's something which Birthright, I think, quite reasonably has reacted against.
I would say as well, if you are listening and you are of those opinions, you are welcome to come to the Bagel Podcast. I'd love to chat to you. This is a place for all those differences of opinion. I'm just curious about the kind of what happens during crisis mode. Right, so you get a phone call, I'm presuming in, you know, whatever time it is, going, this thing has happened. And you might not be able to talk about it, I understand, but what's the process for that? What's your process of crisis management?
So the real crisis that we had to deal with in my tenure was the Gaza conflict in 2014, where we had some people who were in Israel already and some people who were due to go to Israel. And in consultation with the authorities in Israel, something called the Cheder Matzav, the Situation Room, which is run through the Israeli Ministry of Education, but coordinates all the programs that come to Israel, we realized very quickly that A, we could keep people in Israel safely, which was our top priority, but we would have to make some significant adjustments to programs to make sure no one was in range of rockets. And we also had to run a quite significant communication strategy with the youth movements and with parents and the wider community. So we created a situation room in our offices at UJIA, which was running really all day and all night. I mean, obviously at night we weren't in the building, but through WhatsApp and telephone, you know, it was running. And we would have really four or five conference calls, conference meetings every day with people from Israel and here, just making sure that all of the programs were being run safely and properly and that the communications were being handled effectively. And I think the community was reassured that we knew what we were doing. Very, very few children chose not to go on tour, and everyone went and everyone came back safely. And I think actually it was a model of how you run a situation in that way, which was not simple. I mean, a lot of my staff, including me, barely slept for about 6 weeks. But our priority was to give the young people a really good educational and fun experience, and we managed to do that.
Is it fair to say the overarching lesson that maybe other organisations can learn from is that of communication? That actually, if you are communicating with parents and with the youth movement, that dissipates a lot of that stress beyond the logistics.
Yes, communication is absolutely key. And I think that all of the community organisations have understood that better in the last few years.
Very diplomatically put.
No, but I think it's true. I'm actually not trying to be diplomatic. I think it's true. I think that the level of communication that comes out of the major Jewish community organizations is pretty good today. I think that's quite a healthy state that's going on there.
And what do you think are the major challenges for Jewish charities going forward in the next, say, decade?
So the single biggest challenge will be an aging major donor base. The average age of major donors in our community is not getting younger. That's not to say that young people are not generous. They are generous, but their giving patterns are different. So all the charities are going to have to adjust to different ways of raising funds and distributing funds. I would say that's the number one. Related to that, of course, is the sheer number of charities in the community. And Jonathan Goldstein, the chair of JLC, spoke about this both at Libud and other forums recently, and he's quite correct. There are too many charities in the community, and that means that both the professional and the volunteer leadership are going to need to address that issue, I would say, sooner rather than later.
In what way?
I think where possible, to have collaboration and to have mergers is very good, and some charities will no doubt close and their work was taken up by other ones. It's not a question of whether this is good or bad. It's just going to happen because the number of charities is not sustainable in the long run of a community of our size.
Fair enough. Could we get? I'd like to maybe get a bit onto your story, if that's okay.
So
what you were born in London, correct?
Yes, I was born in London. I was born in Palmer's Green and raised in Palmer's Green, and was very involved in youth movement and FZY.
I won't hold it against you.
That's okay, thank you. And I went on to Israel with FZY, and a gap year in FZY. I'd spent 5 months in Israel earlier because I went to JFS on their Give Up Washington program. So Israel very much entered my blood. And I pretty much knew by the time I got back from my gap year that I was going to make Aliyah, which indeed I did. I went to university, I studied, and then I made Aliyah. And I've spent most of the last 25 years in Israel, but with 3 periods abroad, including this one.
So where else have you been?
The States. We spent 3 wonderful years in the States, in Baltimore, where I was Director of Jewish Education for the Jewish Community Centres in Baltimore.
Was that that must have been quite a different role to heading up UJIA?
It was completely different, but it was a role that was really teaching. I really taught most of the time adult education, both in the JCC and in the wider Baltimore Jewish community. And also, I was a guest teacher all over the States. So I got to see America from coast to coast. Baltimore was interesting. It's 100,000 Jews, of which about 25,000 are ultra-Orthodox. You have a very, very big ultra-Orthodox yeshiva there called Ner Israel, a very fine establishment, and a very significant, generally Orthodox community. And then, of course, very, very prominent Reform and Conservative synagogues as well. So it was a nice mishmash. In that way, it was quite like London, in the blend of Orthodox and non-Orthodox Jews.
But that was it seems to be very different in America. I was in Florida a few years ago and there was a young professionals event that rotated every month between Reform, Orthodox and Conservative. And I just can't imagine that happening here.
Yes, there's because the Orthodox are not a majority in United States, and because there is no such thing as a chief rabbi or a Beth Din with a certain worldview, there are less issues about Reform, Orthodox, Conservative rabbis talking to each other and appearing on platforms.
Fraternizing.
So I wouldn't want to romanticize it. There are, of course, tensions in the American Jewish community, but you do find it's not uncommon for strictly Orthodox and non-Orthodox progressive movements to have greater degrees of collaboration than sometimes you'll see here.
Do you think we'll ever get to a point here where that collaboration will happen?
Well, it's already happening here in frameworks that are not around religion, right? So projects such as Mitzvah Day, for example, or Shabbat UK, I think have done pretty well in bringing different denominations to take part together.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the perception that Shabbat UK is quite united synagogue-ish.
Well, certainly the Masoreti movement has agreed to take part over the last couple of years. I don't know whether the Reform and Liberal movement have, so I can't say. But Mitzvah Day is a good example where you see quite clearly people from different branches of Judaism coming together and collaborating. I think as long as theology isn't the issue, generally people are quite comfortable about working together. I think sometimes theology can get in the way.
So I kind of want to go back to the path to UJIA, but I just find it quite... What skills did you need to have, and what have your founders helped you in your role as chief exec?
Sure. So up until my previous job in Israel, I had not really done any fundraising. And of course, UJIA is a fundraising organization. But I had a lot of experience in management and in leadership through education. So I'd run very big projects and big organizations. And in my last role in Israel at an educational charity, I discovered that I could fundraise and I wasn't terrified by it. And in fact, I was quite inspired by a former teacher of mine from Jerusalem, Professor Seymour Fox, who said all fundraising in the Jewish community is really Jewish education. And I sort of took that mantra to heart. So when the position at UJ became available, I decided to apply for it and was fortunate enough to be offered the role. And I really embraced the fundraising piece that came with it. And one of the great pleasures I've had at UJA has been meeting with our donor base at every level, not only major donors, but right throughout the community, and talking to people about Israel and Judaism and the community and their role in it and their concerns. And those conversations are really powerful conversations, and it's what makes our community tick. So I really found that I took to fundraising at every level as something that I found a really empowering and a very satisfying part of my professional life.
So what's the can you give us some tips and tricks? If you're aspiring fundraiser, what should you? But I've heard the thing that said that a good fundraiser should be someone that when they walk into the room, everyone walks away from them.
Well, that wouldn't be a good fundraiser, I think. People walk away from you
because they know you're going to hit them up for money. That's the
yeah. But I don't want that to be how my relationship with our donors is defined. I want my donors, and certainly I say this to the team at UJIA. You want people who you're going to eventually canvass to have a relationship with you, and they want to, they should enjoy talking to you and enjoy being with you and feel they are getting something from you as well. So I think if I saw people running away from any of our fundraising team, that would give me concern. Fundraising is not transactional, it's relational, and that's absolutely key. So the relationship between the canvasser, whether it's professional or volunteer, and people in the community is critical. And I also say to the team, people want to give. Right? They wouldn't take a meeting from you if they didn't want to give. Now, they might not give to you. They might in the end decide that giving to UJA is not what they want, and they'd rather give somewhere else. But that's okay. If they are giving, if they are generous, if they're philanthropic, that's what's so important, because that's what makes the community tick. But I would say the key is to have a good relationship with people, to be clear what you're asking for, to be able to either answer their questions or admit you don't know and then be able to go back to them with answers, to be transparent, to be honest, and eventually to be direct. You know, you can't be vague about fundraising. You have to be clear that you're making an ask, what you want that ask to be. And those, I think, are some of the key tips for the trade. It's a privilege to be part of that that work, and anyone listening who is thinking about a career in fundraising, I would be only encouraging.
Do you find out of interest, you find it's easier to fundraise for things rather than generally, you know, UGIA? Do you know what I mean? So I can remember I was a trustee at my students' union. They always said that you get the alumni to pay for a bench before they'd pay for a staff member.
So UGIA, and I think several of the other charities, are all going through this transition now, where once upon a time, donors to the British Jewish community were happy to give to a pot because they understood that the organisation they were giving to was doing great work and they trusted the organisation to deliver that work on their behalf. That is still the case for many, many people, but we're also seeing a different group emerge in the community who do want their donation to be targeted, something specific. It might be a building, it might be a programme. And so all of the charities, all charities generally, I don't think only in the Jewish community, I think everywhere in the world of philanthropy, need to consider and take into consideration both types of donor. Those who will continue to give to the pot because they just broadly understand and accept the cause, and those who want something more specific. So that's part of the skill set of the fundraiser, is understanding quite quickly what the donor wants and being responsive to her or his particular fundraising strategy and style.
You were saying a bit before about, the demographics are changing. So how is that going to look, when all the wealthy people die off, I suppose, to be blunt? How will that fundraising approach change?
So all the wealthy people will not die off. I think that's, Hayden don't mind me saying, I'm not sure that's how the world operates. But the next generation of major donors will give differently to their parents and grandparents. That's for sure true. And charities are going to need to be flexible and dynamic and be able to work with this new reality. So in UGIA, one of the things that we have done recently is we've set up a social impact innovation fund, SI3 we call it, focused on Israel. And the idea there is people will give gifts which we will offer to various companies in Israel as loans, repayable back loans, which are doing both social good and giving back a financial return and connecting British Jews to Israel. So we give those loans, they will then come back to UGIA, and then in discussion with the donor, we will reallocate it to a new cause. So it's like a green gift. It's a gift that keeps on giving. So one very small example is there are very few Ethiopian Israelis who run their own small businesses. So we've created a fund together with partners in Israel, giving Ethiopians the opportunity to create their own businesses. One young woman I met this year has created her own salon for doing makeup for weddings, for brides, and also providing them with wedding dresses, which they can borrow. So she's created her own small business in that way, and we've helped her expand it and develop it. It's a very, very tangible example of how this new type of giving will emerge and develop.
I do find UGIA does tend to, the projects I've heard over the years, does tend to have a certain imagination to them. I've been to, the university, is it, you'll definitely correct me. No, it's not Bethel. Is it Bethel? No, there's a university that's the half Arab, half Israeli university.
So the Western Galilee College in Akko is a college which we've done both capital build, we helped build the new business school there, and also we have a lot of educational enrichment programs there and a bursary program for students. And it is indeed a college that is split roughly evenly between Jews and Arabs. And it's a really wonderful program in Akko.
So why would you fund that?
So we took the view, really a decade plus ago, that in order to upgrade the quality of life in the Galilee, where there was less opportunity and less development than one has in the middle of the country, Tel Aviv, Netanya, Herzliya, the colleges, as they're called, were a very important vehicle of change. They were able to give people professional qualifications rather than sort of liberal arts degrees that would enable them to move.
I've got a liberal arts degree, watch.
So have I, and I love my liberal arts degree, and there's no problem with liberal arts degrees, but for most people living in the Akko area, a liberal arts degree wasn't what they were looking for and wouldn't necessarily have helped them. And so the Western Galilee College and the Tel Chai College, and there are other examples, focused much more both on scientific programs and professional programs, which were perceived by both the Israeli government and by local authorities to give a better track, would have a better chance of getting people into meaningful employment. And I think that has been successful. And these colleges are booming in Israel today. I do realize I may have given the impression that I'm hostile to liberal arts degrees. I'm absolutely not. But I think liberal arts degrees suit a certain type of person. But really, for most people, a liberal arts degree is probably not something that's going to be, in the context of Northern Israel,
and it doesn't get you a direct job, I suppose. Is no. The, yeah, I get that point. And so there's that side in terms of the projects in Israel that I would say, as a kind of outsider, has a large level of pragmatism to it, right? You know, in terms of making life better for everybody, and then that will ultimately help everything. On the flip side, I'd like to just talk a little bit about the British projects. Is so UJIA is a Zionist organisation, I think that's fair to say.
So the word Zionist,
okay,
does not appear in our charitable documents because Zionism itself is not charitable. It's interesting, under British charity law. So whilst it's absolutely true that the majority of people who work for UJIA, our trustees, our staff, are of course Zionist, an organisation itself can't be Zionist.
Can we explore that a little bit? So what? Why not?
Under British charity law,
Does it specifically say like Zionism?
We consult. Or? We consult, of course, with charity lawyers all the time about this sort of thing. And I'm not a lawyer, so you may want to bring in a lawyer to talk more about it. But from our point of view, what we're able to do as a charity is advance the welfare of people in Israel. That's of course supporting the people of Israel. Is absolutely fine, and engaging in education about Israel and Judaism is also fine. So technically, those are the things that we are able to do. But yes, of course, I personally am a Zionist, and indeed, I would say almost all of my colleagues would define themselves in that way, as would our trustees. But just want to be quite clear in case I was being misunderstood about. I'm very aware of the minefield that is here at play.
No, it's easy. There's no minefield. What are you talking? Yeah, I've had plenty of interesting debates on that, so maybe let's not go down that road. But so fine. So there's the projects that are based in Israel that legalistically aren't Zionistic, and then in the UK there's projects that aren't, right? They're not against Israel, but they're more supporting local Jewish communities.
Right, but one of the shifts we've done in UJIA, and this is going back into, I mean, organizational history might bore people, and I don't want to bore people, but the...
I'll edit it out, don't worry about it.
The work that we do in the UK is all around Israel. So we really have stopped funding projects now that are not around Israel. So in the origins of UJIA, we were putting quite a lot of money into community institutions that were not focused on Israel. That's now stopped. And we realised we had to be much tighter and much more focused in our work. So really, everything we do now has Israel at its core.
Oh, interesting. So why was that decision taken?
Because there was a sense that the message was confusing, both to ourselves and to the community. What does UJ stand for? So I like to say it, you know, UJ stands for Israel. We do Israel here and we do Israel there. And that way, I think you just don't have any confusion anymore.
Right. Well, yeah, you add another level of confusion when you say it used to have Palestine in the name of its charity, right?
Indeed, we were called the Joint Palestine Appeal for many, many, many years. That's absolutely right. In fact, it wasn't until, I believe, 1973...
No.
Yes.
Wow.
And we can thank Sir Trevor Chin, who was a part of the group that made that change. But we became the JIA, the Joint Israel Appeal, only in 1973, which I agree is pretty extraordinary.
That is an... if anyone's listening and they're doing a Jewish pub quiz, that should go definitely
indeed
down on there. So just before we finish, what's next? What's your big plan? Can you divulge?
I really can't divulge right now. There are some big plans. Maybe we'll have to do a recap of this interview in a couple of weeks' time, a few weeks' time, when things will be a bit clearer. But certainly I'll be staying in the area of Israel and Jewish education and fundraising, those sorts of areas.
That sounds... I'll just wait until you're the presidential consultant, right? You're staying very quiet. Staying very, very quiet. Michael Weegar, thank you very, very much for your time. And I wish you all the very best with whatever it is you end up doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed.
Again, many thanks to Michael. This was a few weeks ago, so I asked him what's next, and the international man of mystery replied with, I'm going to be starting work as a consultant in fundraising and strategy for major international NGOs, both in and out of the Jewish community. Answers on a postcard. That's it for this Bagel Bite. The next main episode will be a Pesach Passover special, but I may release one more bite before then. See you next time, bagelers.